Every Seder we have must, in the evening, must always be connected experientially in our minds to the belief, the certainty in the ultimate dawning of deliverance. Everything that we do at the Seder, no matter how terrible Jewish history is at the moment, is meant to reaffirm our belief in a revelational and salvational God who will one day redeem us as he redeemed Israel and Egypt.
The Tikva Fund is proud to present The Haggadah, a political classic, a series of 8 audio recordings that together make up a full course on the most beloved and most popular work of Jewish liturgy. Our teacher is Rabbi Dr. Meir Soloveitchik of Congregation Sherith Israel, the oldest Jewish congregation in the United States. Rabbi Soloveitchik is also the director of the Zahava and Moshe L. Strauss Center for Torah and Western Thought at Yeshiva University. In these lectures, you'll hear Rabbi Soloveitchik explore the text of the Haggadah as a source of political and moral wisdom, bringing out its deeper arguments about family, memory, and the human condition, about politics and freedom, about history and sacrifice. This episode is Rabbi Akiva's blessing, destruction, freedom, and endurance.
In 1944, Isaiah Berlin, later a celebrated political philosopher, was working for English intelligence in the British Embassy in Washington, D.C. Churchill would receive Berlin's dispatches, and he could sense the brilliance of the writer of these reports, and he yearned to actually get the opportunity to meet this Mr. Berlin in person, to talk politics, to talk about the war, to talk about foreign policy, and much else. Then, in May of that year, London was visited, not by Isaiah Berlin, but by Irving Berlin, the American songwriter with the distinction of having composed the best-selling Christmas song of all time, and by a Jew, of course, as well. Irving Berlin made a very generous donation to the British war effort to a charity that was overseen by Clementine Churchill. And so Mrs. Churchill said to her husband, she said, you know, Mr. Berlin is in town, and he's been very generous to us. And so if you meet him, tell him we're very pleased with him. So Churchill said, Mr. Berlin? Oh, I want him to come to lunch. And Clementine said, no, that's not necessary. If you meet him, just pat him on the shoulder, say you're very grateful to him. And he says, no, I want him to come to lunch. And she didn't understand why. So Irving Berlin is invited to lunch with Winston Churchill. I'm quoting one version of this story. And Churchill thinks this is Isaiah Berlin. And so he says to him, Mr. Berlin, this is a true story, by the way. He says to him, Mr. Berlin, what is the most important piece of work that you have done for us lately, in your opinion? And so Berlin, of course, has no idea what's going on here. So he says, I don't know, I guess White Christmas, I suppose. So then Churchill turns to Berlin again. And he says, do you think Roosevelt will be reelected this year? And Irving Berlin said, well, in the past I have voted for him myself. This year I'm not so sure. Now at this point, Churchill is entirely confused. So Winston finally says to Berlin, he says, Mr. Berlin, when do you think the European war is going to end? And Irving Berlin says, sir, I shall never forget this moment. When I go back to my own country, I shall tell my children and my children's children that in the spring of 1944, the Prime Minister of Great Britain asked me when the European war was going to end. Churchill was very displeased about all this, and he got up, got upset, left, lunch was over. Poor Irving Berlin went back to the Savoy, and he says to his friend, Sir Alexander Korda, he says, you know, Mr. Churchill is probably the greatest man in England, or in the world maybe, but I don't know what it was. I somehow felt we did not click. I don't know what it was. Mrs. Churchill, she's a wonderful woman. I could talk to her always. But with him, I don't know, something. I just can't make it out. And meanwhile, Churchill said to his own staff, he says, Berlin's just like most bureaucrats. Wonderful on paper, but disappointing when you meet him face to face. Now, our Haggadah devotes 2 whole paragraphs to describing another meal featuring leaders, political thinkers, statesmen, philosophers. It is a meal about which everybody reads, but here too, at this meal, much is missed by most as to what is going on. And some of what is missed stems from the fact that people fail to note, as with Churchill, not only who is at this meal, but who is missing from this meal, who should be there, but actually is not present. The story is ostensibly nothing other than that of a seder of the sages, who are telling the tale of the Exodus all night, until they are interrupted by their students, who inform them, time for Shema. Let us just briefly quote the paragraph in the original Hebrew. Ma'aseh Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Yeshua, Rabbi Lazar ben Azariah, Rabbi Kiva, Rabbi Tarfon, Shohim Esub b'nei Brak. The rabbis Eliezer, Rabbi Yeshua, Elazar ben Azariah, Akiva, and Tarfon are getting together to mark the Pesach Seder in B'nai Brak. This is in Rabbi Akiva's home, because B'nai Brak is where he lives. Vayu misaprim b'yitziat Mitzrayim kolo to'alayla. They are telling the story of the Exodus all night. Ad shabau talmideim v'amru lahem, Rabotenu igia zman kriyat shema shel shachrit. All of a sudden, their students show up in the morning and say, our masters, the time for the morning Shema has occurred. The next paragraph features a reflection from one of these rabbis at the Seder, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, seemingly in response to his students who just show up. Maimonides' version of the Agadah makes this explicit with the next paragraph beginning, Amar Lahem, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah then responded to his students who came in and said, time for the morning Shema. Elazar ben Azariah says as follows, Hareani kiven shivim shana, behold, I am akin to 70 years old. V'lo zachiti sh'te'amer yitziat Mitzrayim balelot. But I have not yet, until now, I have not found a source that obligates one in mentioning the Exodus every night. Ad sh'darsha ben Zoma. Until just now, a rabbi by the name of Ben Zoma has found such a source. Meaning, it was always assumed that the daily recital of the Shema in the morning must also include a mention of the Exodus. That is why the Shema concludes with the paragraph that begins Vayomer and ends Ani Ad Hashem Elokeichem Asher Hotzeiti Etchem Me'aretz Mitzrayim. I am the Lord your God who took you out of Egypt. So it was assumed that in the morning one is obligated every morning to make mention of Yitziat Mitzrayim, of the Exodus. But now Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah says to his students, only now has a source been discovered, attributed to the sage known as Ben Zoma, a source that obligates us when we say the Shema every evening to mention the Exodus every night as well. Ben Zoma, says Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, has discovered an obligation to remember the Exodus daily, not only in the morning, but in the evening, to recall our freedom from slavery, not only on the night of Pesach, but every night of the year. That's the paragraph. But the conversation actually seems a bit stilted when you think about it. Students come in and tell their masters, it's the time for the morning Shema. And Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah essentially responds in a seeming non sequitur. Hey, speaking of the morning Shema, a new source has been discovered that teaches us that the nighttime Shema should also mention the Exodus, which is not a very good segue at all. What's going on here? Why does he mention this? And why does this mentioning by Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah merit it being quoted in the Haggadah? Let's set the historical stage. Jerusalem has only recently fallen at the hands of the Romans. The temple has just been destroyed. Fleeing Jerusalem right before the destruction, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai establishes an academy at Yavneh, stepping aside from the leadership of the academy and the leadership of the Sanhedrin when a descendant of Hillel, Rabban Gamliel, arrives. Because Hillel's family was always awarded the position of Nasi, patriarch. And the patriarch, the Nasi, embodied the leadership of the Jewish people, both political and religious, head of the Sanhedrin and representative of the Jews before Caesar. And if this position was important before 70 CE, before the destruction, it's all the more important after, because all the other factions in Jerusalem of Jews that were not loyal to the rabbis and were not loyal to Pharisaic Judaism, the Sadducees, the Zealots, the Sicarii, they all die out and disappear. And suddenly the Nasi of the Sanhedrin is effectively the leader of basically all Jews or most Jews throughout the Holy Land. Meanwhile, Rabban Gamliel, acting as Nasi in Yavneh, has another challenge. Without Jerusalem, with Jews dispersed and no locus of devotion, he has to ensure the future of Jewish law, which he sees not incorrectly as tied to the authority of the Sanhedrin, and first and foremost tied to his leadership of that judicial and political body. He therefore sought to impose his own halachic views in all Jewish legal debates, publicly shaming those sages who disagreed with him, causing those other sages, who were the students or the students of the students, not of him, but of Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, to chafe under what they saw as Rabban Gamliel's extreme authoritarianism. And after three uncomfortable experiences in which dissenters were singled out, the other rabbis, as reported in Tractate Brachot, rebelled and kicked him out of the academy and fired him as Nasi, as patriarch. They then offered the position of patriarch to Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah because, they said, he is wealthy, so he will work as a politician. He can represent us before Caesar. But he also has, unlike Rabbi Akiva, the most brilliant of the rabbis, more on that in a moment, he has a distinguished lineage akin to the patriarch from the house of Hillel. He, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, is a descendant of Ezra. So we'll offer the position to him. So they come to him and they say, would you like, according to the Talmud, they say, would you like to become the Nasi? And he responds, I need to ask my wife. And this, ladies and gentlemen, is the most Talmudic passage in the history of Judaism. Okay? Actually, Lord Jacobovitz, or Rabbi Emanuel Jacobovitz, tells that when Margaret Thatcher called him up and offered to place him in the House of Lords, to make him a lord and to basically create the first rabbi rabbinic peer, the first rabbinic member of the House of Lords in the 1,000-year history of the House of Lords, he said, I need to ask my wife. And he calls his wife and he says to her, would you like to become a lady? And she said, yes. So Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah similarly goes to ask Mrs. Elazar ben Azariah, and she first says to her husband about the job, he says, well, they fired the last guy. How do you know they're just going to not do the same thing to you, right? And he says, well, maybe they will, but, you know, it's worth a shot anyway. But then she says, according to the Talmud, but how can anyone respect you in this position? You're relatively young, and you have no white hair in your beard. And that night, says the Talmud, 18 rows of just such a type of hair appeared in his beard. And that, the Talmud reports, is why Elazar ben Azariah says, as quoted in the Haggadah, Harei ani kiven shivim shina. I am like 70 years old. He was not actually 70 years old, according to the Talmud. He was younger than that, but he looked. He didn't look a day over 70. That's how he looked. Which means then, according to the Talmud, then, that it's at that moment that this Seder takes place. The moment where he says, Harei ani kiven shivim shana, behold, I am like 70 years old, is taking place at this moment in the debate over the future of Jewish leadership. And that allows us to understand why at the Seder in Bnei Brak, all the great rabbis of the generation are there, but not the man who, up till this time, has been officially the head of the Sanhedrin, descendant of the house of Hillel, which was, by the way, descended from the house of David. Rabban Gamliel is not there at the Seder. And he's not there because he's been fired, which would make for a very uncomfortable Seder if all of a sudden he shows up. He was fired because his colleagues considered him to have failed at the primary challenge facing Jewish leadership, which is to allow the flourishing of diverse Torah views and interpretations to bloom at the academy in Yavne. Rabban Gamliel, meanwhile, as he saw it, had been struggling to preserve the authority of the Nasi in an age where the temple, where the temple was destroyed, and he was seeking to stave off anarchy and to prevent the rising of a generation where every Jew would just do whatever was right in his own eyes. And then the Jews would fragment and fall apart. It's in this context that the new Nasi, the new patriarch, Elazar ben Azariah, joins his colleagues in the home of Rabbi Akiva in Bnei Brak. But what most people miss is the incredible drama in the words, V'hayu misaprin b'yitziat Mitzrayim kol oto halayla, that at this Seder, in Bnei Brak, the rabbis were telling the story of the Exodus all night. Why is this dramatic? It's dramatic because it's not at all obvious that they should be extending the Seder this late, this far. The Talmud itself records a debate in the academy at Yavne that had taken place between the participants in this Seder, between Rabbi Akiva, the host, also known as the most brilliant of the rabbis there, and Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, the new Nasi. And at issue in this debate was the question of how long the eating of the Paschal Lamb in temple times, and therefore how long the Seder, even lacking the Paschal Lamb, was supposed to extend. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah insisted that in Egypt itself, the Paschal Lamb was consumed only until midnight, which is when the plague of the firstborn occurred. The Israelites in Egypt then did nothing till the morning, and at dawn, they left Egypt. Meanwhile, Rabbi Akiva insisted that the eating of the Paschal lamb in Egypt continued until dawn. They were eating all the way until they had to rush out of there. And the Talmud further explains that this debate extends to whenever the Paschal lamb is brought. According to Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, you have to finish eating the lamb by midnight. And according to Rabbi Kiva, you can eat it till dawn. Moreover, say the rabbis, this debate about the deadline for eating the lamb is also applied to the question of how long the obligation to recite the story of the Exodus extends. According to Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, just as the eating of the central mitzvah, the central commandment of the night, extends only till midnight, so too, one is only obligated to tell the story of the Exodus for Passover until midnight. According to Rabbi Kiva, just as the eating of the lamb extends till morning, so too, the special Passover obligation to recreate and retell the Exodus extends until morning. So now you have these two different people who disagree about how long the Seder is supposed to go. They are eating together on Passover Eve. So what is set up is a potential, ostensibly inevitable clash between Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, the new political and religious leader, and Rabbi Akiva, the most brilliant scholar among them, who is also the host of this Seder. And so as midnight approaches, a question is facing these rabbis, and especially these two rabbis who can potentially clash. And the question is not just whether they finish at midnight. That's reflective of a larger political question, which is, how will leadership work in this new era? How will the new Nasi skirt the rock and the hard place of total authoritarianism on the one hand and religious anarchy on the other? Who's going to win out here? Will it be Rabbi Akiva and the Seder will go all night? Or will Rabbi Elazar win with the Seder concluding at midnight? For Rabbi Elazar himself, the new Nasi, the dilemma is exquisite. He has just taken this job. According to the Talmud, tensions are so fraught that they have expelled Rabban Gamliel, the scion of Hillel and the house of David, whose family has held this position for generations, and they have installed a young guy who didn't even have white hair in his beard. If he does nothing to illustrate his authority, his position as the Nasi is one of impotence. If he cracks down rudely in the home of his host, then the study hall could rebel again. And just as his wife had warned him, just as they fired the last guy, they can fire him as well. So what happens? Superficially, we know what happens. The Seder continues. It would seem that Rabbi Kiva has won this round. They continue all the way till the morning. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah seems to have, contrary to his own view, continued the Seder throughout the night. So Rabbi Jonathan Sacks assumes, in his own interesting essay on this passage, he suggests that the Seder went all night because the Nasi, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, was so entranced by the telling of the Exodus that he lost track of time. He puts it this way, quote, "So engrossed were Rabbi Elazar and his colleagues that they failed to notice when the deadline of midnight has passed. They were still talking when the disciples arrived. The evening had passed without the question of time limits arriving, and Rabbi Kiva had succeeded in establishing the law." That's how Rabbi Sacks interprets this. And this is interesting, but I would respectfully disagree and take a different approach for two reasons. First, actually, according to many, if not most, decisors, the law does not actually follow Elazar, does not actually follow Rabbi Akiva. It follows Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. But more fundamentally, if the issue is truly as fraught as Rabbi Sacks acknowledges, then you don't accidentally miss the passage of time and go all night. It seems a bridge too far. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah can walk and chew gum at the same time. He can discuss the Exodus and still note the passage of time and tell a story about Rabbi Soloveitchik, Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik, who would commute from Boston to Yeshiva University to teach, that when he would come to Yeshiva, he would stay in an apartment on the first floor of one of the student dormitories. So one evening, late in the evening, very, very late, in the middle of the night, there was loud rock music coming from the room of a student in the dorm room right above Rabbi Soloveitchik's little apartment. So Rabbi Soloveitchik puts on his house coat, dressing gown, whatever, robe, goes up to the second floor, knocks on this poor student's door. The student opens his door, sees Rabbi Soloveitchik standing right in front of him. Rabbi Soloveitchik looks at him sternly and says, "It's 3 o'clock in the morning. People are trying to learn." Okay. So, you know, you can learn Torah and keep track of the time. And surely Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah can do that too. And so studied carefully, I would suggest that what occurs is the opposite of Rabbi Sacks' interpretation. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah actually here both preserves his power and his authority without quashing Rabbi Akiva. What he does is an act of political brilliance and extraordinary emotional intelligence. And what this illustrates is not merely something remarkable about him, but about the nature of political judgment and political leadership in general. And here we turn to the writings of the man whose writings had impressed Churchill and whom he, Churchill, had hoped to meet. And that is Isaiah Berlin, who wrote a paper long after he was sending reports to Churchill in the war, a paper that is called On Political Judgment. And in this essay, Isaiah Berlin, not Irving Berlin, ponders the fact that truly gifted leaders do not seem to be responding to just a set of rules. Leaders do not just have a code or a Shulchan Aruch, which teaches them how to lead. Rather, there is a certain instinct or emotional intelligence that they seem to apply. And they're able to apply this differently in different situations because each situation is unique. Berlin writes as follows. The gift we mean, meaning political judgment, the gift we mean entails, above all, a capacity for integrating a vast amalgam of constantly changing, multicolored, evanescent, perpetually overlapping data. Too many, too swift, too intermingled to be caught and pinned down and labeled like so many individual butterflies. To integrate in this sense is to see the data as elements in a single pattern, with their implications, to see them as symptoms of past and future possibilities, in terms of what you or others can or will do to them, and what they can or will do to others or to you. To seize a situation in this sense, he writes, one needs to see, to be given a kind of direct, almost sensuous contact with the relevant data, and not merely to recognize their general characteristics, to classify them or reason about them or analyze them or reach conclusions or formulate theories about them. What, Berlin says, are we to call this kind of capacity? Practical wisdom, practical reason, perhaps a sense of what will work and what will not. And here's the money quote. He says it is a capacity in the first place for synthesis rather than analysis, for knowledge in the sense in which trainers know their animals or parents their children or conductors their orchestras, as opposed to that in which chemists know the content of their test tubes, or mathematicians know the rules that their symbols obey. This means, in other words, end quote, this means that truly great leadership is an art, not a science. The great leader cannot just follow the same rules all the time. He must seize the moment, the unique moment in which he finds him or herself. With that in mind, let's study what Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah does in this situation. The discussion continues past midnight, and he is well aware of the time. He is being gracious. He's allowing for the opinion of his host to be instantiated in the home of his host. He need not say anything. But then, all of a sudden, his students come in. Now the students see that he has not been following his own opinion, but rather has been telling the story of the Exodus at the Seder all night. Now there is a danger that the students will draw the wrong conclusion here, that they will draw the conclusion that the Nasi, the new Nasi, has no authority, and that he has capitulated. They will see one small action that the new leader does, and they will draw the wrong conclusion, because students are apt to do that. There is a story, actually, about Rabbi Soloveitchik's uncle, known as the Briska Rav, Rabbi Velvel Soloveitchik, whose students were known for their zealous mimicking of their rabbi and teacher. And so the story is told that he was actually going to light Hanukkah candles once, and there was a broom lying on the floor that was blocking his path. So he wondered to himself, he says, what should I do here? He says, if I leave it there, my students every year will think that there is a special stringency to have a broom on the floor whenever you light Hanukkah candles. But if I remove the broom, then my students will think that there's a special stringency that you're not allowed to have a broom on the floor when you light the Hanukkah candles. And so he picked up the broom and he said to his students, I want you to know that I'm not doing this for any halachic reason. I'm just moving the broom because it's in my way. And from then on, his students every year, before lighting Hanukkah candles, would hold up a broom and say, I'm not doing this for any reason. I'm just doing it because it's in my way. And so here he has a real problem, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. Students come in. They see that he's been telling the Seder all night, contrary to his own opinion. They can draw the implication that he has capitulated, that he has no power. So what does he do now? Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah inserts a seeming non sequitur whose meaning is actually clear. The students enter, and they mention that it is time for the morning Shema. And he, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, responds with a seemingly irrelevant point. He says, speaking of the morning Shema, you know there's an obligation to talk about the Exodus every night. The ostensibly clumsy segue makes his point implicitly. don't deduce from the fact that I was discussing the Exodus after midnight that I conceded to Rabbi Akiva's opinion about the Seder, that the Seder should extend even beyond. If I continue talking about the Exodus even after midnight, it's because there's a mitzvah, a commandment, a value in discussing the Exodus every night of the year. In the presence of his students, he is telling them, graciously, implicitly, but still clearly, don't deduce from this that the law is in accordance with Rabbi Akiva. But Rabbi Akiva's honor is also preserved, just as his own authority is preserved. And no one is shamed. Elazar ben Azariah both allows for other opinions to be expressed and instantiated, and yet elegantly notes, I'm here out of respect for my host, but my view remains firm. It is a remarkable act of leadership without shaming Rabbi Akiva, done with such emotional intelligence that it is a true reflection of what Isaiah Berlin calls seizing a situation in the sense in which one is given a kind of direct, almost sensuous contact with the relevant data. Rabbi Elazar's actions speak to the uniqueness of his moment. He both preserves Rabbi Akiva's honor, perhaps even recognizes the validity of Rabbi Akiva's opinion, but not the normativity of Rabbi Akiva's opinion, signaling that as Nasi, as the head of the Sanhedrin, he does not agree. And this Seder, then, this seemingly simple story, is reflective of the gifted leadership that the Jews found right after the destruction of the temple. Under Elazar ben Azariah, according to the Talmud, the rabbis of Yavna compiled Masechet Ediot, Tractate Ediot, in which many halachic dilemmas were resolved, and conclusions to all these questions were finally codified. At the same time, the rabbis stress, at the very same time that all these questions were being answered and placed into law, this is also a moment of exegetical and interpretive explosion, with so many insights emerging in the study hall at Yavne, that even Rabbi Gamliel, shamed though he is, fired though he is, cannot help himself and comes into the study hall to experience the brilliant interpretations that are being offered. And ultimately, upon repenting, he is restored to share the position with Rabbi Elazar. And what this means is that this little tale is more than just a simple Seder story. It is a tale of Judaism's finding its way as a polity and a society after the destruction of the temple. And though the political disaster that is going to face pretty soon in the years to come will be even worse, that's the Bar Kokhba rebellion and its failure, nevertheless, the legal framework for the application of Jewish law is set here, and it ensures both the vitality and also the cohesiveness of the Jewish people for the next 17 centuries, till the Enlightenment, till modernity. With the Essenes, Sadducees, Zealots, and other movements disappearing, and Rabbinic Judaism is all that is left, challenged largely for the next 17 centuries only by the Karaites, what remains here is a constant interplay throughout the history of Rabbinic Judaism, an interplay between interpretation and codification, an allowance for diversity and diverse views, but within a halachic framework. The codes that are developed ultimately, the codes that endure, the Mishnah, the Talmud several centuries after that, the Shulchan Aruch many centuries after that, all of these allow for the expression of the dissenting views while working our way toward a normative law. The Mishnah will state the halacha and will note those who dissent, even though we don't practice that view. Same thing with the Talmud. Same thing with Shulchan Aruch as well. All of these works are religiously normative, to be sure, but they do more than just state the law. In balancing interpretation and codification, diversity and normativity, disagreement and final conclusion, legality with some elasticity in noting other views, the approach set in motion at this Seder and under his rulership, the rulership of Elazar ben Azariah, this approach allows for the Jewish people to retain their identity as one nation. Ultimately, the Nasi'et, the office of the patriarch, was returned to the family of Gamliel and Hillel. But it was the small period of Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah and its impact on halachic history that allowed the Jewish people to endure as one nation as they dispersed all over the world. This system of leadership that was developed and the political craft that was applied allowed for debate, cherishes debate, and yet slowly works toward a conclusion. The theology behind this approach is the notion, as the Talmud expresses, that Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chayim. In a rabbinic debate, both positions are the words of the living God, meaning they are both insights into the mind of God. But nevertheless, Rabbinic Judaism continues to insist that to keep the community together, one view must be adopted, even as both views are cherished Both views are examined. Both views are celebrated. Both views are studied. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah is compared in rabbinic texts, as academics note, to a funnel, one who allows for the expression and the outpouring of a variety of views, a wide expression of approaches, in the belief that these and these are the views of the living God, but nevertheless funnels them all toward a conclusion. To keep us together as a community, he believed, we must work ourselves toward a normative halakha that can integrate diverse Jewish communities under one law. So this Seder in Bnei Brak, in a moment of exquisite political and halachic leadership, can be understood as preserving the authority of the Nasi, but also as preserving or even cherishing Rabbi Akiva's opinion as an expression of the mind of the living God. And this means that even if the law technically follows Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, and according to many authorities it does, for many legal authorities conclude that the afikoman today, which parallels the eating of the Paschal lamb, must be eaten before midnight. Nevertheless, because Rabbi Akiva's view was also preserved and cherished and celebrated, the idea at the essence of Rabbi Akiva's approach, actually, when we look carefully, pervades the Haggadah and indeed Jewish history itself. Let me explain what I mean by that. When we consider it, we realize that Rabbi Akiva's view of the Seder reflects his larger worldview as well. We have note Rabbi Akiva lived the most remarkable life of all of the rabbis. An illiterate shepherd at the age of 40 becomes the greatest rabbi that Judaism has known. And yet we have no memoir of Rabbi Akiva's remarkable life. A success story like this nowadays, Rabbi Akiva would be on Oprah telling his story. And then Oprah would be like, everyone gets a Talmud, you get a Talmud, and you get a Talmud, and you get a Talmud. Okay, but we have no version of Augustine's confessions. Augustine did not live that much long, you know, that far after Rabbi Akiva. But Judaism doesn't have biographies or autobiographies. As Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein once put it, our Johnsons have no Boswells. And so what we have are just snapshots, stories in the Talmudic text about Rabbi Akiva here and there. But pieced together, they allow us a glimpse of his unusual personality and most notably his singular character trait, which is his extraordinary optimism. And it is this optimism, according to the Talmud, that not only enabled him to overcome severe challenges in his own life, but also and more importantly enabled the Jewish people under his encouragement and leadership to endure the destruction of Jerusalem and the exile at the hands of the Romans. Thus, the Talmud, at the end of Tractate Makot, famously recounts two trips that he took with his fellow rabbis. And note who is here at this time in the story. Rabban Gamliel, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, Rabbi Yeshua, and Rabbi Akiva were walking in the vicinity of Rome. So says the Talmud. So they were actually in Rome. They are passing the Forum, the center of civilization at the time. From far away, even before they came, they heard the great sounds of this incredible, incredible metropolis. I'm quoting a translation. And they began to cry, and Rabbi Akiva laughed. And they said, why are you laughing? And he said, well, why are you crying? And they responded, these barbarians who bow to idols and burn incense to false gods are living in this extraordinary power and security, while the footstool of God, meaning the temple, is burnt in fire, how can we not cry? And he said to them, that is why I am laughing. If people who violate the will of God are right now in this wonderful condition, how much better will those who act according to this will ultimately be rewarded? And then the Talmud concludes by saying that these same rabbis were walking on Mount Scopus and they saw the temple and they tore their clothing. And then when they arrived at the Temple Mount, they saw a fox running out of the area where the Holy of Holies had stood. And they began to cry. And again, Rabbi Akiva laughed. And the same thing is recreated. Why are you crying? Why are you laughing? Why are you crying? And they said to him, how can we not cry? A place where only the high priest can enter and now animals are running there? And he said, that is why I am laughing. Because the same prophets that predicted the destruction of this place, and that prediction was fulfilled, so too the prophet's prediction that the Jews will return will also be fulfilled. And one day Isaiah's prophecy that grandparents and grandchildren will sit in the streets of Jerusalem will one day again be instantiated. And hearing that, his colleagues responded to him and said, Akiva nechamtanu, Akiva nechamtanu. Rabbi Akiva, you have comforted us. Akiva, you have comforted us. So Rabbi Akiva thus embodies the certainty of redemption, the belief in a God who keeps his promises, the belief that we must respond to all challenges by laughter in the face of destruction, faith in the face of seeming disaster. And when we examine the story of the Haggadah and the debate that lies at the heart of it, we realize that his optimistic worldview is actually reflected in his legal debate with Rabbi Elazar. Does the Seder of the evening continue till dawn? The question connects not only to technical law, but also to worldview. When the Paschal lamb was eaten in Egypt, protecting the Israelites from the plague, they were still slaves. When the dawn came, they were freed. For Rabbi Elazar, these were two separate events. They ate till midnight, and then 6 hours later, they were free. For Rabbi Akiva, this is all one event. The Seder goes till dawn, and with dawn comes the deliverance. And what that means philosophically for Rabbi Akiva is that whatever Seder we have must in the evening must always be connected experientially in our minds to the belief, the certainty in the ultimate dawning of deliverance. Everything that we do at the Seder, no matter how terrible Jewish history is at the moment, is meant to reaffirm our belief in a revelational and salvational God who will one day redeem us as he redeemed Israel and Egypt. Just as the original Seder went from nighttime of slavery all the way till dawn, we who may find ourselves in slavery as well must laugh in the face of our enemies, as Rabbi Akiva did, and allow the Seder itself to develop within us a certainty in the ultimate dawning of our deliverance. This is what Rabbi Akiva teaches to the Jewish people. And while the law, according to many authorities, is technically in accordance with Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Akiva's worldview dominated and defined the Jewish people, but also the conclusion of the Magid portion of the Haggadah, the blessing before the drinking of the second cup. This bracha, this blessing that we all say today, was, according to the Mishnah, written by Rabbi Akiva. During temple times, the blessing was very short. They would conclude the recital of the Haggadah over the second cup with the statement, "Blessed are you, Lord our God, who has redeemed our ancestors from Egypt and brought us to this day to eat the Passover Paschal lamb, matzah and maror." End of blessing. What happens when the temple is destroyed? Rabbis say, okay, we'll just take out the word Passover Paschal lamb. "Blessed are you, Lord our God, who took our ancestors out of Egypt and brought us to this day to eat matzah and maror." And Rabbi Akiva said, no. If we are exiled from Jerusalem, we must amend the final blessing and draw on the experience of the Seder to maintain our certainty in our ultimate return to Jerusalem. And that is how we end the Haggadah, that Magid portion of the Seder, to this day. "Blessed are you, Lord our God, who redeemed our ancestors from Egypt and brought us to this day to eat matzah and maror." And then we continue with words written, composed by Akiva. "Kein adushem elokeinu yagiinu l'madim l'gar machem rabban l'kriteinu l'shalom, smechim b'vinan yirech v'sosem avodotecha, v'nuchal shamin apsachim min azvachim." So too will you, God, may you bring us back to Jerusalem, rejoicing in the rebuilding of your city, where we will eat of the Paschal sacrifice, which will one day again be offered upon the altar, and then it concludes with the political and spiritual together. "V'nodu l'cha," and we will sing to you, and we will thank you, "al gu'ulatenu," on our future redemption, "v'al pedut nafshenu," and the redemption of our souls. "Blessed are you, O God, who redeems Israel." All composed by Rabbi Akiva. It is Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik who, once speaking in Yiddish, reflected on the audacity that this blessing expresses. As he put it, he said, can you imagine Rabbi Akiva at this terror, the winter of Jewish history, when the notion that Jews would return to Jerusalem seemed impossible. Whereas he put it in Yiddish, he said, "Von die ganze historische Wirklichkeit hat gespott und gelacht von der Hashkofas Elon." When the entire historical reality spat and laughed at Rabbi Akiva's worldview, "von Benken noch a land," of longing for a land, "von Hoffen auf a Mashiach," and hoping for a Messiah, "von Haben a Beis Hamikdash," and having a temple, "was Menschen haben gesagt, das ist kein nicht kommen," which almost any rational human being would have said, this is impossible. Jews will not return. Grandparents will no longer watch their grandchildren play in the streets of Jerusalem. Mikiva said, the Seder that we have, the experience of the redeeming God in Egypt, must always conclude with our certainty, the dawn of deliverance. Halachically, it may not hold in accordance with Rabbi Akiva that we must connect the Seder to the dawn. But philosophically, that is precisely what occurred. Almost nobody takes their Seder till dawn today. But they all conclude the Magid portion by connecting redemption of past to redemption of the future. by connecting their own observance of Pesach with a faith in the ultimate dawn and sunrise of Jewish history that is yet to come. And they conclude the Seder as well in the spirit of Rabbi Akiva next year in Jerusalem. On the technical question of whether the Paschal Lamb must be finished before midnight or till when the Seder extends, law may not follow Akiva. But because his view was not quashed, the philosophical notion that it expressed, that our Seder must always connect with our eagerness for and our belief in the dawn of deliverance, and that our recollection of Exodus past ensures our belief in the Exodus that is yet to be, that became part of our Haggadah, and that defined the endurance of the Jewish people itself. Rabbi Sachs once recounts that he was standing on Mount Scopus in Jerusalem when he suddenly realized that it was, quote, here that Rabbi Akiva and his colleagues stood, contemplating the ruins of what had been Judaism's holiest place, and where Rabbi Akiva and his comrades gave his comrades the, quote, courage to hope, end quote. I know what Rabbi Sachs means, because my wife and I had the opportunity to visit the other location where Rabbi Akiva once stood with his colleagues, and that was in Rome. And if you visit the Capitoline Museum and you overlook the ruins of the Roman Forum, you realize that it was there or in the vicinity that Rabbi Akiva once heard the extraordinary noise coming from what was once the mightiest and wealthiest place on earth and predicted its ruin at a time when no one could have ever predicted. And here the Jewish people remain. I had the opportunity of speaking in the Vatican. I walked into the Vatican wearing my hat so nobody saw my skullcap, and the Swiss guard there said to me, good morning, Father. And I resisted the urge to say, bless you, my son. Gave a speech about Jewish philosophy. Came to a lunch in the Vatican where there was a kosher table with a mashkiach in the Vatican. And I was thinking, if only Rabbi Akiva could see that Latin appears only in this tiny city-state and on one ATM machine in Vatican City in Rome, and grandparents watch their grandchildren play in the streets of Jerusalem. He predicted this. He saw it. And he insisted that our Seder must always be connected with the dawn of deliverance. His view, while technically not necessarily followed by his colleagues, was nevertheless cherished, and the philosophy at its core infiltrates our entire Haggadah and all of Jewish history. Hope, writes Rabbi Sachs, is not a mere instinct. It is born in faith, the faith that God exists, that he keeps his promises, and that he forgives. A people that never loses hope cannot be defeated. The Jewish people kept hope alive. Hope kept the Jewish people alive. For the endurance of our halachic system, we have Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah and his political brilliance to thank. And for our survival, for our endurance, we have Rabbi Akiva to thank. And it may well be that we owe all of this to the openness, the grace, the emotional intelligence, and the pure political skill that was shown in Rabbi Akiva's home at a Seder in Bnei Brak millennia ago. Thank you very much.